Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, all from our website, kgov.com, or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist? Bob Enyart Debates Atheist Zaketh, a Psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the Earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realsciencefriday.com. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, today, the Creation Magazine, you and I have been accused of doing a terrible thing.
What's that, Bob?
When we talk about carbon-14, which decays in only thousands of years, not millions, and you find it in dinosaur fossils and amber and gas and all, we've been accused of misleading our audience. Because a lot of people don't have a science background. So why don't we check out this nuclear physicist from Canada?
It'll be interesting to see what he has to say.
And see if we tricked him.
Will he confirm or deny this story?
About carbon-14 showing that all these things are young and not millions of years old. So we'll see if we tricked him. I don't know how far Real Science Friday goes.
Okay.
It's 50,000 watts here in Colorado, but also I'd love for us to start with an article from creation.com on cell division. This is so fun. And Fred, you're an engineer, so I would love to give you a challenge related to cell division.
To cell division, okay.
Because it's really
staggeringly complex.
It is. But first, of course, this is September, our annual telethon to keep Bob Enyart Live and Real Science Friday on the internet for another year. Fred, we're 9% of the way toward our goal of $20,000.
9%. Okay. So we need to get that up to 100% or more.
That's right. Right now we're at $1,800. We're close to 10%. That'd be another $200. People could make a donation, make a monthly pledge, or they could get some of our science materials.
Yeah, and you've got a great one here by Illustria Media Production. I mean, they're awesome.
Yeah, they
and there's
are.
A 3-DVD package with Unlocking the Mystery of Life, which is one of my favorites.
So good.
The Privileged Planet is fantastic. They showed that on PBS even. That was a shock.
Just tremendous.
Yeah, and then Darwin's Dilemma. These are very well-produced videos.
Yeah. They're Nova quality videos, including
absolutely.
With their animation and their photography, nature photography. And they're anti-Darwinist, and they're fascinating.
Yeah, they're,
all right,
they
so,
really are.
So
how
that
much
package,
for that is for?
Well, say $50, and we only have half a dozen of these, so they're not on our store. They're beautifully packaged all together, all three DVDs from Illustra Media. That would be super.
Make a great gift for somebody.
$50, or maybe somebody could even give some extra to help us reach our goal. $70, $100, or more. I would be so thankful, and we get to keep doing this and reaching more people.
That's right, and both radio and the internet.
Yeah. So, okay, Fred, this article on meta information at creation.com about cell division, could we talk about the challenge of taking the DNA molecule in the nucleus of a cell and dividing it so you have two copies? because if you're going to divide a cell into two cells, they both need a copy of your DNA.
Yeah. So that's an engineering challenge in itself, right?
I think so, because there are how many base pairs of amino acids are in that chain, that ladder in a single DNA molecule?
In a human, about 3 billion.
3 billion?
3 billion little pieces of information.
Okay, and you got to make a copy of all that. And Carl Sagan has said it's like the information in thousands of books.
Thousands of books, so like a big library.
Yeah. So, Fred, you're an engineer. Could I give you a challenge?
Sure.
Here are the system requirements.
Okay.
You have to make a system that'll duplicate the information in thousands of books that are in a room, and you got to copy every letter from every page of every book in sequence, one book after the other, all in order, and go through the stacks until you've copied it all.
Okay.
All right? Is that sounding difficult?
You know, it's not sounding horribly difficult. It's a challenge, but, you know, you set up an algorithm to copy from this particular order. Maybe there's a sequence number on all these different books so you can know to copy them in the right order. Mm. So that by itself isn't tremendous.
You can't get it out of order. And you,
yeah.
Okay. But.
Uh-oh. Okay, there's an if condition that sounds
now, like. Now, the system that you're creating has to be able to work not only in this one room, but in billions of rooms like it with the same stacks and the same books. And while you're doing it, it has to be done quickly because we don't have a lot of room for you to take months filling up a spare room of this thing. It has to be done quickly. And while you're doing it, people are going to be checking the books in and out constantly.
Oh, wow. And I still have to have an exact copy of the library in a different place later on.
That's right. So if you get to a certain point, like book number 872, and somebody's checked out the next four books, you've got to make sure that your copy has those books, the content, in the right place in the right order.
So I have to remember books that have been removed.
Well, yeah, that would be one way of doing it. That's up to you as the design engineer how you want to do that. So, Fred, this is what happens in our cells when they divide. The cell itself, in order to survive, it needs access to the DNA. So there's constantly this access to these instructions on how to make proteins and all. And as they're being accessed in thousands of places, you cannot get at that part of the DNA, yet you have to copy the whole thing accurately.
Wow, that's a tremendous problem. And then what about the case where somebody comes and grabs a book right when you're trying to copy it?
Right.
So who gets precedence there?
Who gets precedence?
Do I grab the book out of the guy's hand?
There might be a fight.
There might be a fight.
Yeah, you could imagine that, right?
Yeah, one would take precedence. So I would say the customer, you know, customer comes first. And that's kind of how the cell works, right?
Yeah. So could you describe, now, I don't know how you would solve that, but we know how the creator solved it. At least we're beginning to learn how the creator solved that tremendous logistics problem. It's an engineering problem.
It is, and it's amazing what happens. What they're learning is that replication doesn't start at point A. It starts at a myriad of thousands of different possible places it can start.
Wait, I would think that the duplicating begins at the beginning, like the first rung on the ladder, and it just keeps going through the whole thing till you get
to 3 billion.
And what
I thought as an engineer, that's how I would have started off doing it with a simple duplication process.
But it would take very long.
Yeah, and
for one process to go sequentially through the whole thing.
Well, not only that, if you've got people coming in and taking books out and you got to keep track of that,
then you might reach something and that gets complicated.
Yeah. So basically what it sounds like the cell is doing is it doesn't start replicating at one single place. It has thousands of places it can start. There's little pieces.
Thousands of places the DNA molecule is being replicated all at the same time?
Yeah, and it knows advantageous places to start.
Oh, wow.
And it puts a priority, too, that if the cell needs to be translated to do some function in the body, that takes precedence over the cell division part.
Oh, my. And this is being explored by geneticists even as we speak. But there was an article in a technical journal called Nature Reviews Genetics. And that article is described at creation.com online, CMI, Creation Ministries International, in an article on meta-information. Meta-information.
Yeah.
No, information about information.
That's right.
And what Alex Williams says he thinks is going on, as this is a new field of learning, that when machinery within the cell comes to the nucleus and says, we need information from this part of the DNA, we need this kind of information, the nucleus management says, now, wait a minute, we were going to start copying that part. We're in the middle of mitosis here.
Yeah,
we're in the middle of mitosis. So here's what we're going to do. In this neighborhood of the DNA molecule, we're going to start the duplication at this point. So you go ahead, you take what you need for now. We're going to start over here, and then that replication start site notifies everything nearby, okay, all you guys, don't copy. I'm beginning here. And then it begins to copy there.
So it's more efficient, so you don't have copying starting at the adjacent places. It doesn't need to be that way.
Right. So apparently there are thousands of places that our genetic machinery knows that it's optimal to start copying here if none of the molecular machinery needs the stuff you're about to copy. And once you get copying, tell your neighboring sites, guys, don't worry, I've started here. This happens at thousands of places.
Yeah. So this article talks about two different kinds of information. They use a good analogy, I think, and that's the, say, recipe for a cake.
Yeah.
So you got information that's the ingredients, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the instructions themselves of what to do with the ingredients.
Instructions. Without the instructions, the recipe doesn't help.
It doesn't make sense. And, you know, there's also the whole translation mechanism. You have to be able to know what the information means.
And even the instructions. There has to be a higher level of comprehension so you know how to follow the instructions.
That's right. It's important to be able to understand information.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bob, moi pense que c'était un ballet.
Huh?
Huh?
Okay.
me denkt, he's un said weissel.
Fred, what are you talking about? Fred, okay, speaking tongues.
I just said in French and then in German, very badly, probably.
Yeah.
That methinks it is a weasel.
Oh.
So you didn't know what I was saying.
No.
Because you didn't have
the
ability to translate
that.
It. But
yeah.
Someone else would have been able to translate that.
Mm.
So it was information, but it wasn't realized.
It's useless.
It's useless unless you know what to do with it.
Right. And that adds so much to the complexity of our DNA and our genome. So it's really fascinating. The more we look at how God created, the more awestruck everyone is becoming, simply awestruck. And it's so much fun.
It is. It's just incredible. The information problem, as we've said many times, is just a death knell to evolution.
Mm.
Because these two pieces of information, these two types of information, this meta type information, this the instructions that then put together the ingredient pieces mm-hmm. of information, those are dependent on each other.
Mm.
Now, isn't evolution based on random, independent events?
Yeah, that's right. Mutation with natural selection, they say. But first, you need the random accidental change. And it's going to take more time than if every atom in the universe was a laboratory trying 1,000 times a second. You'd need more time than the universe exists to get a few of the proteins in just one simplest living human cell. It's a mathematically impossible concept.
It really is.
And it again, is refuted mathematically.
That's right. That's why you never really get strong arguments from mathematicians who are evolutionists. You don't really hear much from them, do you?
Right. In fact, the mathematicians tend to be the group of scientists who have the most hesitancy to support Darwinism.
That's right.
Okay, so that's from molecular biology and how awesome it is, how God designed to replicate a cell.
A cell,
cell
nucleus.
Division. And that's called mitosis, right?
Mitosis.
And that's when the cell has a nucleus.
When a cell has a nucleus, that's a...
That's a... What is that called? That's a...
Eukaryote.
Eukaryota.
Eukaryota?
I'll carry Chewbacca.
Eukaryota. Okay.
See, it's hard to remember that word. Eukaryotes, their cells, a eukaryote is
a
cell
nucleus.
That has a nucleus. As compared to a prokaryote.
Yep.
And so you carry Yoda, I'll carry Chewbacca. That's how I could remember that.
Hey, that's a good way to remember
it. But you have to know Yoda well because you have to be able to call him, hey, Yote. Hey, Yote. You carry Yote, I'll carry Chewbacca.
So Yote's short for Yoda?
Yeah. When you have cell division with the nucleus and the DNA, this sophisticated problem is solved by starting in thousands of locations in a coordinated way.
And what's amazing, as we've talked before on the show, is how the DNA is not just read in one direction. It's read backwards. Yes. How could, can you imagine writing a book that's written pretty much in 3D?
Yeah.
How does that work?
It's just, it's
you
God.
You couldn't do it.
It's got God written all over it. So from molecular biology to physics, we have been accused of deceiving people about carbon-14. It's one of our favorite arguments because it decays. All physicists agree with this. It decays not in millions of years, but thousands. And some specimen with carbon-14 in it cannot be millions of years old. It has to have died or been formed just thousands of years ago.
Yeah, to have carbon-14, or it could have been contaminated, and we'll talk about that,
yeah.
Right?
Okay, yeah. So there is a nuclear physicist in Canada, and the current Creation magazine, at least the one for summer 2011, has an interview with this Dr. Jim Mason. And Fred, this is fun. He's one of Canada's leading physicists.
Oh, he really is. He's been vice president and the engineering and chief technical officer of Canada's leading defense electronic systems companies. You know, it's a big deal to be the chief architect for a company, to be their chief technology officer. You have to know what you're doing.
Yeah, and he got his Bachelor of Science in Engineering Physics in Ontario, Canada, at a major university. And he got his PhD in Experimental Nuclear Physics in Ontario. He's been doing this for about 40 years. So he's an experienced, successful, qualified nuclear physicist.
That's right. So, yeah, you'd think he'd be able to either confirm or deny this story out there that we're misleading people about carbon-14.
Yeah. And so before we get to that, could we talk for a moment about what he says about the forces in physics? There are four basic forces: the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force. That's easy to remember, strong and weak. There's the electromagnetic force. And the weakest of all is gravity. And there's a quote in here from Dr. Jim Mason that really parallels many other brilliant scientists. And he talks about how these are fine-tuned.
Yeah, he says that the relationship between these forces is so finely tuned that even a slight change in just one of these relationships would render the universe as we know it impossible. I mean, we're talking a very, very minute change in the relationship between these,
and these
it's
forces,
incredibly finely tuned.
These forces cover such a range of strength, and they behave so differently. Like, gravity only attracts. Electromagnetic force, it attracts and it repels. And these both act over infinitely long distances. That's pretty interesting. But the strong force acts only within the nucleus, Fred, keeping the nucleus from flying apart.
Yeah.
So that is so fascinating. This very important strong force acts within this infinitesimal distance, and electromagnetism and gravity operate over virtually infinite distances. So when you look at that, you see that these forces are all finely tuned, and they operate together in the most astounding
way. They do. They interact together, and it is. It's amazing how fine-tuned they are. And scientists, secular scientists, know of this problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, Albert Einstein built on the work of James Clerk Maxwell. Remember his eloquent equations? And he's the founder of the science of electromagnetism, which is so crucial to understanding the physical world. And Jim Mason agrees with something that James Clerk Maxwell once wrote. And Maxwell, who's a giant among the founders of the physical sciences, he was a creationist.
That's right. He lived in the 19th century, right? Between 1831 and 1879.
Yeah, that's right. And he lived for 20 years after Darwin published
so he was in the
Origin of
Species. That era of time where they were really pushing evolution and millions of years and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. He quoted James Maxwell, who said, "No theory of evolution can be formed to account for the similarity of molecules, for evolution necessarily implies continuous change. The exact equality of each molecule to all others of the same kind gives it the essential character of a manufactured article, manufactured designed article, and precludes the idea of its being eternal and self-existent. It's not something that happened by chance."
And the argument by atheists is only ignorant people who don't know science, who don't have a scientific intuition, they're the only ones who would believe in a creator. Well, so many of the founders of the physical sciences, as we've covered, were creationists, including Maxwell. So here is Dr. Jim Mason, one of Canada's leading nuclear physicists, and he's on board with this big time. Fred, he says that there are unverifiable assumptions in the claims that, say, rocks or dinosaur fossils are millions of years old, and these rocks are billions of years old. And he gives examples. He says that in the case where the actual age of the rock is known, radiometric dating techniques typically give wildly erroneous ages. For example, Mount St. Helens. We've talked about this a lot, right? That erupted in 1980.
Yeah, so we know how old those rocks are.
Yeah, right. Well, there was another lava flow from Mount St. Helens in 1986, and it's been radiometrically dated as being 2.6 million years old. So Jim Mason points out, hey, if over and over you find out that things that you know the answer to, you get totally wrong answers, wouldn't you begin to question the accuracy of that source of information?
Yeah. So when we date rocks where we know the age and the dates are always wrong, why are we expected to trust the dates of these rocks that are supposedly millions of years old,
right,
where you have this great vast amount of time where things could really upset the apple cart, you know, because of all these assumptions that he mentions that are built into radiometric dating?
Yeah, so Jim Mason, nuclear physicist, describes what you and I have talked about, that there's carbon-14 in coal and diamonds, and how this is overwhelming evidence that they're not millions of years old. So he goes through this, and first, maybe if we could look at the section on coal, where have they taken the coal samples from to do their testing?
Different parts of the United States.
Yeah, coal seams from regionally around the U.S. And supposedly, these coal seams are really old, right?
Yeah, they're supposedly 37 to 318 million years old.
Whoa, that's almost a factor of 10. Between 40 and 300 million years old. And so when you test them to see how old they are, you'd think you'd find out that there'd be this tremendous range. Well, when you do carbon-14 dating of those coal specimens, something amazing.
Well, first of all, you shouldn't even be able to do carbon-14 dating, because if they're that old, there should be no carbon-14 in there, because carbon-14 has a half-life of about 5,700 years. Mm. So after about 90,000 years, it should have decayed into nitrogen.
It
should be gone.
It's gone.
So they really don't carbon date it, because carbon-14 dating wouldn't work on something they think is millions of years old, because carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,700 years. Mm-hmm. So after about 90,000 years, it'll decay back into nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So it should be long gone. It should not even be in the sample.
Right. So they expect to find none. In fact, they find so much that these laboratories have very sensitive equipment.
They've gotten much better at detecting carbon.
They really have. In fact, they're beginning to count individual atoms. That's how good they are. And the amount of carbon-14 they're finding in coal from all over the U.S. is 100 times greater than the sensitivity of the instruments they're using.
100 times more carbon-14
than the instruments are certified to be able to count accurately. So it's not as though we're at the edge of the instrument's ability and we're just getting bad numbers.
Yeah.
Not only that, regardless of the claimed age of the coal seam, you know, 30 million years or 300 million years, it all has about the same amount of carbon-14. And that is about as much as you'd expect if the coal was 50,000 years old.
Yeah, so what that really says is that this coal formed at about the same time in the past.
The coal all formed about the same time,
It doesn't say that it formed 50,000 years ago, because there's assumptions built in.
There are assumptions built in, including how much carbon-14 was in the atmosphere when the Earth was originally created.
That's right.
It's constantly formed in the atmosphere, and it's reasonable to conclude that there was none. And the global flood had a tremendous effect on the C12-C14 ratio.
But we would expect the dates to be about the same, right?
About the same, and having carbon-14, which shows that this coal hasn't been there for millions of years.
That's right. So they can try to blame it on, like, contamination, and that can happen. You can get carbon-14 contamination on a coal sample. Mm-hmm. But even if they're extremely careful, They take all precautions necessary. They still find carbon-14 in coal. They find it in natural gas. And guess where else they find it where they can't blame it on contamination?
Where?
Well, he mentions it here in this article.
He does. And this is Jim Mason, a nuclear physicist from Canada, very successful, long career. And he talks about carbon-14 in diamonds.
Diamonds, the hardest substance on the planet.
Diamonds are a creationist best friend.
They are. Absolutely.
So, Fred, could you explain why Jim Mason thinks carbon-14 in diamonds is such powerful evidence that diamonds are not a billion years old, as the geologists say? They say they're a billion years old. Mm-hmm. Jim Mason says, look, there's carbon-14 in these diamonds. This is powerful evidence.
Well, again, because diamonds are so hard, they're rigidly packed crystals of carbon. So carbon-14 can't leach into a diamond. It just can't happen. Mm-hmm. That means the carbon-14 was in there from the beginning, but it can't be there if the diamond is millions of years old.
Yeah, Jim Mason, nuclear physicist, says that the diamond is impervious to the alleged possible contamination that has been used to try to dismiss the results for coal. And, you know, they find it in amber and gas and dinosaur fossils and everywhere it shouldn't be. Carbon-14 is turning up.
That's right. And then again, it should long have decayed into nitrogen. It shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. It's like an hourglass that you turn over, a 1 hour hourglass, the sand should be at the bottom.
Yeah.
We're finding these hourglasses and all this stuff with sand still in the top part.
Still in the top. And Jim Mason points out, nuclear physicist, that there's the same amount of carbon-14 in diamonds as there is in coal, regardless. So you have from 30 million years to a billion years or more for diamonds, and we find about the same amount of carbon-14. This is powerful evidence that there is something divine going on, because the laws of physics say this is not possible, because carbon-14 cannot last more than thousands of years. It cannot. If it does, that means all of their radiometric dating is completely untrustworthy,
yeah.
All of it.
Science refutes the old age arguments. It's so clear right here. Mm-hmm. They have no explanation for this.
Yeah. So I don't think we tricked a Canadian nuclear physicist into believing our carbon-14 argument.
Well, and you know, we're 50,000 kilowatts, and maybe it gets up there into Canada. Hmm. But yeah, apparently he wouldn't have been tricked.
No.
He would have agreed with us.
No. And Jim Mason not only is a Christian, he became a Christian later in his life. But Fred, he talks about the foundation of Christianity being in the first 11 chapters of Genesis.
That's right. I mean, it's the foundation of the Bible. Doesn't Jesus quote Genesis more than any other book?
Yeah. And right here, Jim Mason says, without these chapters, the beginning of Genesis, being taken as historical narrative and plainly understood, the rest of the Bible, and in particular, the New Testament message of salvation, does not compute. It would destroy the gospel by destroying Adam and Eve. They disappear. Original sin disappears. Death through sin disappears. The need for a savior disappears. And indeed, in the end, Jim Mason writes, salvation and eternal life disappear. And then he says, the Big Bang says nothing created everything, versus the Bible that teaches that everything was created by the Word of God.
That's right. That's why it's so important to defend the foundation of the Bible. So believing in millions of years and being a Christian, it can put you on a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm. So, Fred Williams, thank you. This is our telethon month at Bob and Yurt Live and Real Science Friday. Boy, how badly we need people to support us. We just don't have a megachurch keeping us on the air and on the internet for another year.
And this DVD package is great.
$50 for the Intelligent Design 3 DVD package, and you can donate $20 a month or subscribe to Bob and Yurt Live.